pretty amazing chapter that we've got under consideration. Invitation was 2:16. Real impressive chapter. So much there to consider, and kind of took me off guard that we were going to cut back on a song.
Okay.
I'm sure you guys will help me keep it going. Song of Moses. Some writers refer to this song as a poem, a didactic, basically instructive poem, and I think we will see that loud and clear, and plenty of things to consider as Moses, you know, again is trying to encourage and instruct and warn and exhort Israel. People, a nation that he loved dearly. There's at least three recorded songs by Moses, and it's interesting to consider these. Psalms 90 is considered one of the oldest psalms. And I just realized I forgot to put my notes in here to tell me when to click to the next slide, so it's probably going to get a little ugly after this next slide, so you're going to have to bear with me as I continue to try to learn how to use this tool. Okay, slide number 3. Here we go. Lauren, you're going to have to help me. I don't...
I wasn't here last week.
Bart, that's
last.
You were last? Okay. Okay. So question number 1, how does Moses describe God? By the way, Levi, excellent job of reading. I mean, reading that poem, that structure was tough. You did a very good job. I appreciate that. How does Moses describe God at the outset of this song? That would be verses 1 through 3. Logan?
Well, there are several words to describe God here. And the first is that he is the rock. He's perfect. He is justice and without injustice. He's righteous and upright. And possibly the most profound and the most important one of these is that he's the rock, because this is a very important theme throughout the Bible. It's in many different books, but probably the most influential and the most remembered one is in Matthew 7. And that's verses there that say that. It's the parable of the man building his house on a rock. And it's whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, verse 24, Matthew 7, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And then he compares it, a man who didn't follow him is a man who built his rock or built his house on the sand instead.
No, good point, good point. Anyone else? Yeah, Russ?
It says later in this song, there are a few other references to a rock, but it's a lowercase r, rock.
Yeah, I noticed that too. Good point.
It says, verse 31, their rock is not like our rock. Later it says, verse 37, he will say, where are their gods, the rock in which they sought refuge? This is their lowercase rock. It's not going to give them refuge.
Yeah, good point. Good point. And I didn't notice when I read through the chapter the first time until I started looking into the details. Different comments from folks, but verse 3 is actually a command that I hadn't noticed and appreciated. So anyone else? Matt?
It appears Moses is addressing the two witnesses that we discussed a few weeks ago, the heavens and the earth. It says, give ear, heavens, hear, yep. O earth, and then he likens his teaching to rain and dew, meaning it's going to, rain is in the heavens, falls on the earth, so all of these words, these teachings are going to be present in both of those places so they can give witness to what he's saying.
Lauren?
To elaborate a little bit on the rock thing, one of the commentators made this point that the theme of the song is the unchangeable fidelity of the Lord compared to faithless people. Reminds me of Malachi 3:6. It says, I am the Lord, I do not change.
remember back in chapter 31 and verse 19 that the song was described as a witness. We talked about that idea last week, that the law and the song are two witnesses that would be called against Israel. And so a witness belongs in a courtroom, and I think it's important for us to understand that one of the ways to interpret this song is to see it as a lawsuit which God is bringing against Israel. So after the introduction in the first couple of verses describing God's character, in verses 4 through 6 you have the accusation, verse 5 through 6, the accusation, they have corrupted themselves. They are not his children because of their blemish. That's the accusation. And then in verses 7 through 14, there's sort of a refutation of the argument. In verses 15 through 18, there's a very specific indictment, again against Israel. And then 19 through 29, you have the sentence. So this structure follows very similarly the structure that we've seen in the blessings and curses and in Moses' speech back in the last chapter, this idea that a charge is being brought against Israel for their corrupt behavior, for their idolatry, and that's going to bring about a series of consequences. So the song is just like the law. It was to be memorized by the people, put into their heart, so that they knew what would happen as a punishment for their sin. This is a witness against them.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, Bart?
Yeah, this idea of the rock is, I thought about the fact that at the end of this chapter, God again expresses to Moses that you're going to die. And the reason is because of the trespass at Kadesh, which is Numbers 20. He struck the rock twice when he wasn't supposed to. And so, and then over in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 4, Paul references this and says that the rock followed them and that rock was Christ. It's just this idea of this rock theme is just very impressive to me. And I wondered if this was the first time it was used in Scripture that God is a rock. And indeed it is, except for Genesis 49, when Jacob was giving the prophecies of the 12 sons. He does mention that there is a shepherd who will be the stone of Israel. But as far as referring to God as a rock, this is it. So Moses, in a sense, is starting that, as far as I can tell, maybe somebody else knows more, but when I did a search, this is the beginning of this theme of God being a rock.
Yeah, good point. Very good. Something I read pointed out that if you remember when Israel crossed through the Red Sea and it swallowed up Pharaoh and the Egyptians, you remember there was a song at that point. So if you look at that as the beginning of the Exodus, you know, there was a song at the beginning of the Exodus, and now we have a song at the end of the Exodus, because they're just ready to go into the Promised Land. Anyone else on question number one?
Verse 2, maybe we touched on this a little bit. Verse 2, considered by some writers, as Matt kind of touched on it, as a looking forward to even to the doctrine of Christ, the idea that the rain and the dew came from heaven. Yeah, very good.
All right. Question number 2.
Why was it important to remember the days of old? That's verses 7 through 14. Wes?
So these verses are split into three sections. Verse 7 through 9 say, to remember the days of old, to ask your elders, ask your father, and they'll tell you what happened in the old days. Verses 10 through 12 talk about God's providence and how he took care of the people. He guided them through the wilderness as an eagle stirs up its nest and hovers over its young. And so God was providing for them and protecting them. And then verses 13 and 14 talk about what God has given them: honey from the rock, curds from cattle, milk of the flock, fat of lambs, and just reminding them of how God cared for them, provided for them, brought them into the Promised Land. And then after, this gets into the next question, I guess, but then we see that the people failed. They became comfortable, and they stopped relying on God for his providence. And at the end of the last chapter, verse 29, we talked about how Moses is seeing into the future. And he says in verse 29, evil will befall you in the latter days. You will do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger through the work of your hands. And so this song is saying, when that happens, and when you're in those latter days, ask your ancestors, and they'll tell you what God did for us in the past.
Yeah, I found it kind of awkward or odd looking at verse 7 and trying to think how the people would be looking back at this, you know, 50, 100, 200 years later to remember these things. It was kind of interesting. Remember the days of old, and here we are current. And no, we're way out here. Look back and remember the days of old. Anyone else? We have several reasons to remember the days of old. As Wes pointed out, God rescued people. They were on the verge of severe treatment there in Egypt. Anyone else? Lauren, please.
In verses 12 to 14, so it talks about they might draw honey from the rock and oil from the friendly rock and from cattle and milk and flock. So these are blessings that they're going to get in Canaan. This is the first generation going into Canaan. They're looking back to the days of old, so it looks back to the promise given to Abraham in Genesis 13, 14. Genesis 13, chapter 13, verses 14 and 15, of the promise of Canaan, and to Jacob in Genesis 28, 13, of this land of Canaan. So 400 years prior, this promise was given, and now it's being delivered to them. So, you know, the previous verses kind of look back to the Exodus time, to the previous generation, but here they can look back. You know, today we think, you know, when we read this, it doesn't seem to me like a long time, but when we think about recent history, 400 years seems like a, you know, real long time, and this is quite a while that this promise had transpired, and now they're about to.
Oh yeah, I mean, I look at it as the lifespan of this country. It's 100 years is huge in my feeble mind. Bart?
Yeah, this is getting away from the topic at hand a little bit, but verse 8 seems to reference the Tower of Babel incident when the Most High divided the inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. And so I take this, and maybe somebody has a different opinion, but I take this to be a reference to when God separated the peoples and separated the nations, that everybody was of one language and probably one ethnicity, and God separated the peoples, divided the nations, and established the boundaries. We know from the book of Daniel that God has established the boundaries of the nations. And this seems to be referencing that event. And I just find that fascinating. And also it says that he did this when he separated the sons and he set their boundaries. He did it according to the number of the children of Israel. And that's just an interesting phrase. I'm not sure exactly how that works into this. In the Septuagint, it's according to the children, the sons of God, is the way it is in the Septuagint. So I just thought it was interesting whether anyone had any comment about that, how, that and how it might relate to the book of Daniel.
I looked at it as the tribes of Israel as it was dividing up the land. I didn't get into the weeds like that. Anyone else have anything to say on Mark's question? All right. Anyone else on question number two? Okay. Now I'll show slide number three, or question number three. Who was Jeshurun? And what did Jeshurun do that brought about God's judgment? Shahid?
I do think sons of Adam is probably more broad than just Israel.
Yeah.
And I think what Bart said is also repeated in Acts 17 in Paul's sermon at Mars Hill about God setting up boundaries and nations and whatnot, but not sure I can really answer what he was asking. So this is obviously a lengthy section. I can't address every verse here, but what we have here is a warning. Moses warned the people that their undeserved prosperity in the land would tempt them to become proud and to forget about the Lord. This goes all the way back to the early chapters of the book of Deuteronomy, like chapter 8. And then when that happened, God would have to chasten them. And this cycle would be repeated throughout Israel's history. And we have this word, Jeshurun, I think is how it's pronounced, but I'm not sure. And this is from the Hebrew word Yashar. So Yeshurun is how it's pronounced in Hebrew. And it's from the word Yashar. And Yashar means upright. So this means the upright. And you can kind of hear how Yeshurun and Yisrael sound a little bit alike. And usually, the word Yashar, upright, is used sort of as an honorific. It's a word used often for God himself. In fact, in verse 4 of this chapter, the word is used to describe God in the introduction to the song. Here, I think it's being used ironically. I don't think it's being used legitimately. It's being used almost as a jab to underscore how Israel would fail to live up to that upright expectation that God had for them. One of the dominant themes in this section is God's jealousy, which is that of a loving husband whose wife has betrayed him. This has been discussed in Deuteronomy 4. This is the story of the book of Hosea. This is seen in the prophet Jeremiah. To worship idols, we're told here, is to worship demons. Paul affirms this in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 20. And so Israel was prostituting itself. It was committing harlotry against the Lord by going after these idols and worshiping demons. So as a result of that, God was going to try to move them to jealousy, to provoke them to come back to him. And he would do this by blessing and using other nations. The book of Judges might be the best case study in how God would do this. Israel would go into idolatry, and so God would raise up a heathen nation to come and punish the people. They would realize what they had done. They would repent. They would come back to the Lord, and God would raise up a judge to deliver them. That's kind of the idea here, that God would use these nations to provoke Israel to come back to him. And ultimately, of course, this happened in captivity with Assyria and Babylon. This happened in the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans in AD 70. You could even say this happened when the church, which was the purpose of the nation of Israel, to bring the Messiah and his kingdom in the world, was given to the Gentiles, because Israel, by and large, rejected Jesus as the Messiah. So God would bless other people in order to provoke Israel to come back to him.
Thank you. Very good. Anyone else? All right. Question number 4. Oh, there you go. Also mentioned in Isaiah, a version of that word, thought to be the same word. All right, now question number 4. What concern is being expressed in this section of the song? Hunter?
Yes, certainly isn't a cohesive answer. It's kind of difficult here because we're switching back and forth between the theirs, so referring to Israel or Israel's enemies. It's a little bit tricky. As far as the concern, I mean, the concern here is that Israel turns their back on God and no longer follows. But I think really the main theme in this section is more military in nature. Defeat in battle, defeat from other nations that are conquering them. Deuteronomy 28, verse 7, it says, "The Lord will cause your enemies who rise against you to be defeated before your face. They shall come out against you one way and flee before you 7 ways." And then in verse 30, it says, "How could one chase 1,000 and 2 put 10,000 to fight unless their rock had sold them and the Lord had surrendered them?" So I think it's kind of reversing those phrases from earlier that, you know, it is just a reversal of what God and Moses had said earlier. I struggle a little bit with this section.
Yeah, the Deuteronomy 28, verse 7 and verse 25, you know, come in one way and flee seven ways is used a couple different times. Anyone else? Yeah, Lauren?
I took the concern of this section to be what's shown there in verse 27, where it says, lest their adversaries should misunderstand. You know, if God destroyed Israel this time, it would give the Gentiles pride in that they thought they had power to do that. In Exodus 32, verse 12, Moses, he expresses that same concern to God there. He's, you know, that when he's pleading for Israel after the golden calf, that if God destroyed them right then, that the nations would wonder why God, you know, just brought them out there and allowed them to be destroyed. That God didn't have the power to protect them. So it seemed to me that really the only is for Israel's connection with God if they were not destroyed.
Yeah, I found it interesting to try to think about Israel needing to recognize that the Lord was allowing these other nations, these enemies, to prevail over them, and them not, it would seem hard to get it. It would seem hard to realize, yeah, unless this was a weak nation who you'd previously trounced, and now they're trouncing you. I thought that was a possibility, you know, the key concern. I also had verse 28 and 29. The idea of Israel's lack of understanding. I thought that was a significant concern. Their lack of understanding. Void of counsel. The Lord wanted them to be wise and understand these things. And, you know, it's like you can't make them do it. You got to maybe coach them along and help them experience things. But anyone else? Yeah.
I'll try to illustrate it, what I think the concern is. I think I agree with what Lauren said. In Romans 3, Paul is addressing something that was a great mystery to people of faith. And the mystery was, how could a righteous God forgive sin? This baffled them. They didn't understand how this could work. How could a righteous God forgive sin? You know, today, we hear people who say, how could a loving God send a person to hell? But that is the opposite of what Paul wondered. Paul wondered, how could a righteous God forgive a sinner? And he concluded that the way that could happen was through the work of Christ. That the work of Christ proved that God was not only a forgiver, made people righteous, but he was also righteous himself. Because sin had to be punished, and that punishment went on to Jesus. So this was a great mystery Paul wondered about and saw the conclusion. I think we have something similar here. Israel, at this time, was already a nation of reputation. They were already a people who were known to have a powerful God on their side. A God who brought them out of slavery, who crushed the Egyptians, who sustained them through the wilderness, who defeated Bashan and Og and all these on the east side of the Jordan, and who's on the precipice of invading Canaan land. This was a nation that had a reputation. And now, one day, in a very short future, nations, as you said, which they're about to beat very easily in the conquest, peoples are going to suddenly rise up against them and take back land that Israel had conquered and be thorns in their side. Think about the Philistines, who would be thorns in their side for generations. So the question is, how could these people who were so blessed by their God suddenly be subdued so easily? That's the concern of this section. How is it that their God has abandoned them? And how is it now that others can have such supremacy over them? And so you have this struggle in verse 31. Their rock, which I think Wes's point is right, that their rock is like a God with a lowercase g, is not like our rock, even our enemies themselves being judges. So the concern was, if God's enemies can defeat his people, how's that going to make God look? How is that going to reflect on God? It's as if God has no power anymore. So there's a concern about that, and there's going to be a resolution about it here in just a moment. And that was a problem. That was a problem that God had to consider. How would he look to these other nations who he elevates to punish his disobedient people?
Yeah, very good. I like verse 30 also. It's as if the Lord is saying, how can you not see that I'm helping you? Anyone else on question number four? All right. Question number five, how would God ultimately be vindicated? Trace?
Okay. This is a very open-ended question to me. It's a good question, and I think the way I saw it is, there's a lot of ways to look at it, but I think the best way I could see it is it's a continuation of the verses we just got through a little bit, of God being disappointed with his people and their pride, and having to punish them for it with other enemy nations. But this theme is throughout, this whole theme of vindication and vengeance, it's kind of throughout the whole word. Vengeance is mine. There's Romans 12:19, Hebrews 10:30. There's 2 Peter 2:3, Revelations 19:2. So I think it's kind of a trick question also, because the ultimate vindication, I think we can see it through Christ. Because Christ ultimately defeated death. He was resurrected the third day. He defeated death. So he was victorious over death and giving us as Gentiles hope of salvation.
Yeah. Kind of like verse 43 seems pretty strong there. Yeah. Anyone else? Anything else to add? Bart?
Yeah, I really was struck by how there's a lot of similarity between this section of this song and the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation is the culmination of God's vengeance, God's recompense on humanity, and it's full of a similar imagery of God revealing his sword and God coming and blood being as high as the horse's bridle and so on. And I think this is almost apocalyptic, really, this part of the song. And these wicked individuals who their vine is as the vine of Sodom, and they have the grapes of gall and the poison of serpents and so on, they will find their day. The day of vengeance, the day of calamity, again, is a very often discussed theme in the scripture, and that's found here, this day of calamity that is coming. And he says in verse 43, though, rejoice, so that you get all of this imagery of destruction and vengeance and the Lord being the avenger, and yet verse 43 says, rejoice, O Gentiles, with his people, because he will provide atonement for his land and his people. So while Israel may find themselves the subject of, as has been pointed out, these wicked nations judging them and taking advantage of them, and their little rock seemingly being more powerful, God is going to, in the end, assert himself, and that he's going to bring atonement for the true Israel. The true Israel will, as the book of Revelation shows, despite the fact that it's surrounded by all the nations of men, the true Israel will be victorious. Again, I think it's not a mirror image of the book of Revelation.
Yeah, good. Thank you. Sorry?
Traditionally, there are three ways this has been interpreted. One is that this is speaking of the return and restoration of Israel after Babylonian captivity. The language here does not seem to match that at all, because this is talking about a complete annihilation of God's enemies. This is talking about judgment and vengeance on all of those who opposed Israel. And that did not happen when Ezra and Nehemiah and those men led the restoration after Babylonian captivity. They were let loose. They didn't destroy the Persian Empire on their way out. So there was no vengeance at that time. Others have interpreted this, those who have a premillennial bent, as a future kingdom. When a future kingdom will be established and Israel will be converted to Christ in mass, and God will take vengeance on his people. I think those of us who are students of the New Testament, and as Bart said, students of the book of Revelation, know that what Bart answered has to be the correct answer. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. As Bart mentioned, verse 43, "Rejoice, O Gentiles, with his people." This is talking about something that would cause those same enemies to be glad alongside the people of God. Those same Gentile enemies who God was going to punish for beating up on Israel, now they are to rejoice. I mean, rejoice is not at all the right word to use at the end of this section. There's nothing joyful about it. It's bloody and gory, and wouldn't make any of us be happy to see destruction like this. But there's something to be glad about for both the Gentiles and for the Jews, his people, in verse 43. And so the vengeance here ultimately is vindication that occurs when God brings all men and women of all creeds and nations and peoples and tongues and languages together into the body of Christ through the blood of Christ. He will provide atonement for the people. He will forgive their sins. And ultimately, God will be vindicated on the day of judgment when Christ returns to judge the world, and God's righteousness will be manifest for all to see, and destruction will come upon those who have opposed the Lord and his people for all generations prior to that time.
Very good. Thank you. Anyone else? All right. Question number 6. What instructions did Moses give at the close of his song, and what did the Lord tell Moses to do? Dennis?
Well, he told him first of all to, this is really like, to set your heart on all the words which I testify among you today. And I thought immediately Luke 6:45, where it says, "Good man out of a good treasure his heart brings forth good, and evil man out of evil treasure his heart brings forth evil, for out of the abundance of the heart his mouth speaks." And I thought about how the heart, and what you put into it, your heart really is a repository of good, beneficial things or evil, detrimental things. Moses told people to fill your heart up with those good, beneficial things and observe them and teach them to your children. 47, he tells them that it is not an exercise in futility, but your very life depends on it. The second part of the question, he told them to go up and look at the land the Israelites are going to possess. And you can't go there, but I will permit you to look at it. And then it's time for you to die and hand it over to your people.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, somebody's probably counted how many times Moses had warned, exhorted, cautioned Israel to be obedient. You know, here it is yet again. You know, here's Moses. He's winding down. He's getting ready to walk up Mount Nebo. And he's yet again warning, observe all the words of the law. Many, many times. Anyone have anything to add here? Matt?
Something that has been talked about up to this point thoroughly by God and Moses, which is that that the generation prior of Israel will not enter the promised land, and that this younger generation will go in, and other than Caleb and Joshua, of course, and Moses is the last of everyone who is, now of course Moses can't go in for a different reason, obviously, but he is the last of all of those people, and with the ending, consummation of his life, that pretty much allows Israel at that point to go in.
Go ahead, John.
I think last week, and Wes, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but last week Wes might have mentioned that the prophecy of the last chapter that Israel would rebel and turn to idolatry, similar to what we see here in the song, that that might have been discouraging to Joshua. That no matter what you do, Joshua, this is going to happen. Moses declares that it's going to happen. That might have been discouraging. And when he said that, I thought about that. I thought about it a lot over the last week. And I think that's possible. But I wonder, Joshua being here, according to verse 44, if maybe this would have had the opposite effect, that Joshua realizes this is something that's important for us, and this is something that we have to follow, and it's not my fault. It's not because of a lack of ability in myself. These people are going to turn away no matter what I do, but I'm going to do the very best that I can. And that's what Joshua ultimately says when he gives his speeches at the end. As for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord. This is all I can do. I'm going to do my best to lead you, and you're going to go the way that you're going to go. But I also thought a lot about the generation to whom Moses gives this song and speech. They did well. They did really well. For the most part, they followed the Lord. They did not turn to idolatry. This generation succeeded in taking the land. But here's where they fell short. Verse 46, I'm reading from the NIV. He said to them, "Take to heart all the words I've solemnly declared to you this day, so that you may command your children to obey carefully all the words of this law." That's where they failed. They did this. They followed Joshua, but they did not teach their children. And so the next generation that didn't know Joshua and didn't know the miracles that God worked during Joshua's reign as leader, they did not know the Lord, and they did not follow him. And verse 47, I really like this, why I was reading the NIV, how the NIV translates verse 47. "They are not just idle words for you. They are your life. By them you'll live long in the land you are crossing the Jordan to possess."
Yeah, I mean, how many times have we talked about this church? We think about how many people that we've lost, and young people, children of people that were here that no longer attend church. I mean, it's that way all over the brotherhood. Being able to keep our children, help our children have a conviction of their own and remain faithful, how important that is. Exactly right. Wes?
Maybe a very slight twist on that. My reading of verse 47, it's not a futile thing for you when I say that the people are doomed. That doesn't mean give up. It's not futile to trust in the Lord, even though I'm telling you that you're going to fail. And then when it says it's your life, maybe meaning make the most of your life. The generations after you might fail. That's going to happen. But it's your life. You are going to prolong your time if you stay with me and follow my commands. Eventually, the people as a whole will fail. Mm-hmm. But with your life, you can do good.
Yeah, good. Bart?
I was just listening, and it occurred to me from the thoughts that people have made that one of the themes here is of land. And if you go back and you look at those verses near the beginning where God talks about dividing the land at the time, if it is the Tower of Babel, and giving the nations land, as he did at centering their boundaries, now they're entering into the promised land, and they're going to get the land. God is going to allow them to take the land. And then the next section, as Shahe pointed out, was why are the evil nations around them taking back the land? You're going to wonder why that's happened. Is it because our rock has failed? But then the conclusion of the song is God is going to give the promised land to Israel in the end. The victory is that the promised land is the church. And so this theme of God dividing all the nations and then following through all the way is really the promise of the land, the promise of redemption that is found in the land, and that is, of course, in Christ.
Yeah, I appreciate you pointing that out, because that probably comes into play, a little more, because his land and his people, that kind of, that struck me as kind of odd. I'm glad you pointed that out. I thought, well, promised land, I suppose, but maybe symbolic. But yeah, I appreciate you pointing that out. Anyone else? And we've multiple times we've read of the Lord telling Moses, "You're going to die.
you know, you're not going to be allowed to go into Canaan. So we're right there. And Matt, you had made a point that, that I got this from Bart, from Bert and Kaufman, and it's similar to what I think the point you were trying to make, that it was necessary for Moses to die. I hadn't thought about that before, to keep the type more true, to allow that type, to allow Moses to be that type of Christ, to not allow him to go into Canaan. Appreciate everyone's comments, discussion here. Impressive chapter. So much that can be pointed out. Moses' time is just about up. And so it would be interesting to finish up through these remaining chapters and button up the book of Deuteronomy. It's been an impressive, interesting study that we've had. I appreciate so much everyone participating here this evening.